Okay, I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of the Climate Change Adaptation Research at the Environmental Futures Centre at Griffith University, and I'll give you a couple of examples using my own work, which makes it a lot easier for me to give examples. The key, I guess, punchline that we've already heard today in Steve's talk is the climate change adaptation measures, and what we're really targeting here is to reduce the vulnerability of species and ecosystems to impacts of climate change. I'm the Deputy Director of the Environmental Futures Centre, so you'll see that banner up in a few of the slides, and I'm from Griffith University in the School of Environment. So I'll just talk firstly about the role of scientists and how I guess the Environmental Futures Centre perceives our role in climate change. And as a biodiversity specialist, and as a biologist, our real key is to demonstrate the relationships between biodiversity, ecosystem processes and climate, and that way we can use that information to provide guidelines for good, cost-effective, following Hugh's talk, adaptation management measures. So hopefully at the end of all of this we'll get all these great outcomes for in terms of the greater management perspective of ecosystem services. There's a bunch of different projects happening within the Environmental Futures Centre, so you can see there it's a large group of scientists and a lot of postgraduate students working on various projects. The following on from my talk today, Roger Kitching will talk to you no doubt about the IBISCA project, which some of you have heard of, and I'll be talking a little bit today about the PP Bio program. We've got a group of scientists, some of them in this room. Jenny Garden is a postdoctoral fellow working on fragmentation and landscape connectivity in the face of climate change. And Daryl Jones, many of you will know, working on Brisbane roads as barriers to wildlife and also connecting up, spending millions of dollars building bridges over those barriers. Distribution modelling is something that Pat Dale has been involved in a lot, particularly with the mosquito project, and looking at shifts of disease, in particular dengue, moving south in Queensland. And there's a bunch of new projects starting on the physiological responses of biodiversity to both disease and climate, so that's that combination of effects. So I've got a project that we're working on with that at the moment. And Zhu, Professor Zihong Zhu, who's the director of the Environmental Futures Centre, is working a lot on carbon budgets and offsets and linking that biodiversity mitigation with management. I'm going to give you an example, two examples of some of the key core projects that we've been working on in my lab group. The first one is the green-thighed frog project, where we're looking at amphibian response to climate change and trying to model future distributions of these species. So we've got climate does not define the core distribution of many species, and so Notoria brevi palmata is extremely widespread species found between Sydney and Gympie, but it's only known from about 20 ponds in that great broad distribution. So they're found in a handful of locations. So there's a large disparity between that fundamental niche and the realised niche, and this is due to interactions between the species, the climate, the local habitat, and the broader amphibian community. So we're looking at this species at one of those 20 sites in that great distribution. And that, I guess, just to go back here, is funded by Brisbane City Council here at Karawatha. So our aims in this project are to examine the current distribution of green-thighed frogs among the forest ponds that are available at Karawatha, look at the relationships between rainfall, pond hydrology, and amphibian response to those events, so calling and breeding activity, but most importantly, linking it back to breeding success or reproductive success. And for that, of course, we need tadpoles, and we need tadpoles surviving through to metamorphosis. So there's a very strong link between the climate, the hydroperiod in the pond, the calling activity of the frog, and then subsequent reproductive success after tadpoles metamorphose. So the first step then is to model pond hydroperiod in response to those current weather conditions. Then we can go back in time. Using historical weather records, we can predict historical hydroperiods, so we can predict how many times this species might have successfully reproduced over the last 50 years. We've got good data records going back about 50 years. And then we can use those same models to predict into the future using under various climate change scenarios. So just to give you an idea of how that model sort of works, I'm just going to show you a couple of very small visuals, no mathematics, and no complex modelling in this talk at all. But really just the current use of these frogs is they avoid permanent areas because they have fish, and they have to avoid very ephemeral ponds because they won't have water long enough for the tadpoles to successfully metamorphose. So they're bridging that gap somewhere between extreme, ephemeral and permanent. So if we look at the current conditions during the current breeding conditions, we have these permanent water bodies that have fish, and then we have these, after rainfall events, we have enough water to fill these ephemeral ponds for long enough for those frogs to breed. And these frogs seem to be very smart at picking at just the right pond with just the right hydroperiod, and of course without the predators. So it's most likely female selection choosing water bodies without fish as a first thing before she even thinks about connecting with a male and laying her eggs. So we then would predict that under low rainfall scenarios we might have no ponds sustaining water at all in an ephemeral sense. You need a sustained amount of rain before the water table and the water, the soil underneath the ground or the subsurface soil saturates with water before you get water into these ponds. So we can predict what are the likely scenarios. That's great, that's all that good science that Hugh thinks we should be doing, but what does it mean for management? So we've used some Monte Carlo modelling through random but validated iterations to simulate those change in weather patterns, and then we can come up with predictions on how this frog is likely to survive. The management options are pretty straightforward. We can do the science, but the options need the science to tell us how to look after that particular frog. We can protect the diversity of ponds with a range of hydroperiods in a larger area so that we make sure that we capture the right hydroperiod independent of rainfall events. Or alternatively, if things get really bad for this species in this site, then we can go to actual pond management where we might deepen the ponds to increase the hydroperiods under decreased rainfall scenarios. So that's just one example of a project that we're working on that's very applied in the sense of we're modelling a threatened species and a species of frog at one location in Karawatha, and we're looking at options for management. The second example I'm going to show you is much broader in context. It's about the PV Biop program, which some of you have probably heard of, that I've been working on over the last 3 or 4 years, establishing a system of long-term ecological research sites. These research sites are not sites set up for the sake of research. They're very much designed to work in an applied sense, and hopefully I'll demonstrate that to you shortly. Once again, this was actually initiated at Karawatha Forest Park in Brisbane, so it's right in our backyard. So what are we doing? There's a bunch of things that we need long-term ecological research for. So I'll just list them. You've probably seen these before, but they're essential components in terms of understanding the system so that we can work out what we need to manage and how to manage it. So we've got monitoring biodiversity, physiological responses, ecosystem processes, ecosystem health and condition. These are things that we need to see how the ecosystems are functioning so that we can decide where to put our money to mitigate our impacts or to put our money for management. So this is all very much linked to climate change. So long-term ecological research, the reason why I had to slip in a picture of myself with my little girl there was that I always call this my 400 to 4,000 year project. This is establishing a system for long-term ecological research that will last forever, as long as humans might be around. So I'm not presenting to you a specific research project, but a long-term ecological research system. Okay, and of course, finally, tipping points is something that we've heard a lot about in terms of detecting tipping points where ecosystem collapse or species collapse. So for David Lindemeyer, whose chopper didn't land on the ceiling, I've got a picture of the PP Bio conceptual model. If some of you have been following the conceptual and theoretical arguments that have been going on about long-term ecological research, you'll see that David Lindemeyer went to the trouble of writing a paper in Tree, bagging the PP Bio system. He said it was problematic because it didn't have a conceptual model. So I thought, just to allay your fears, we do have a conceptual model. Of course, it could be a red herring, but that's for you to judge and make a decision, or not me. But our real objective is something which is called the hunt for the black swan. And if some of you have read Taylor's book called The Black Swan, which came out a couple of years ago, it's all about predicting the unpredictable, or detecting the unpredictable. And that's our primary objective, rather than regurgitating textbook models. But anyway, that was just for the David Lindemeyer fans. Here we've got a system of grids, and I'll just show you the grids that we've set up in Queensland in the last 4 years. It all started at Karawatha in Brisbane, thanks to Brisbane City Council, who grabbed the idea. We've got Lake Broadwater and the catchment group, which funded setting up plots there. We've gone to Parawinya, which is out west, and that was actually funded by the Save the Bilby Fund in association with Dreamworld, who are running a bilby captive husbandry program. And so this is actually a new release site where they're releasing bilbies. We've got some what I call modules, which are lines of plots up at Kalula, which are particularly interested in hydrology and of coastal dune systems and how that links to vegetation and biodiversity in general. So it's the beginning of a network of array of modules and grids. The original system was set up in Brazil, and there are now grids, 5 by 5 kilometre grids throughout the Amazon, and they're now spreading them throughout the savanna areas of Brazil. I'm actually meeting with a group from Brazil who are coming over in a month or so's time, who are going to be setting up grids of plots in the rainforest in Rio de Janeiro, which, if any of you have been to Rio, the plots are like 45 degrees at best. They're also, I've set some of these up in Nepal, Costa Rica, and next year I'll be going to Oregon to start setting up some of these modules and grids in the United States, the Holy Grail, so to speak. The prime advantage of this is that it is an international system or an international network, and we're using the same methodology for establishing plots, and we're using the same metadata for measuring lots of different things in it. It was listed by the AusLTER, and Tim Clancy's here from the federal government in Canberra, as part of the Australian LTER system. And it's listed internationally under the ILTR, and most recently we've just been joined the ILTR as part of the TERN network, so that's a good thing. Just to show you the system, we've got systematic sampling. There's 33 plots at Karawatha, and each of those plots you can see on the graph there, and the black lines follows the contours. That's just a picture of how the system works, where a midline follows the contours, and you measure out from that midline in any distance, depending on the organism that you're studying. And this system was specifically designed so that it would could be used for ortho rectification and validation and linked directly to satellite imagery. So that's what's really new about this system that's very different to the normal 100 metre straight line. We're doing lots of things, and these are just all those sort of ecosystem processes and links, and these are all done by different students and different projects. So that's basically our model coming back again. I'll just give you a very quick example of some questions that we're looking at, which link directly to climate change, which is obviously a key outcome of any long-term monitoring system. So we're looking at vegetation. That's Sarah Butler in disguise there, some of you will know, from who's now doing a PhD at UQ. And so we're looking at vegetation patterns, condition and health, ecosystem processes which influence those patterns, so that we can model future climate change scenarios and look at management options. And We can also look at things like tree biomass and carbon storage, carbon offsets. This is a good example of mesoscale variation, where we've got plots that have very little biomass and other plots that have very large biomass. So that mesoscale variation in tree carbon or sequestration of carbon is very important and a key outcome. Same thing, scenario for koalas, where we've got these distribution models. We can see here the key areas for koalas. If using a very simple system of a SCATS, looking at SCATS, this was a French student who had never seen a koala or an Australian eucalypt tree before. All the trees and all the plots are all tagged, so she didn't need to identify anything. All we had to do was train her how to identify a koala scat, and away she went, and we're getting some awesome data on the distribution, and she's just redone all of the plots again. So, there are just a couple of the projects that we're working on. Thanks for listening. This work has got lots of support, as you'll see here, but it's really from the bottom up. Brisbane City Council, Condamine Alliance, SEQ Catchments, some of you are here, and collaborations with people at UQ and the Environmental Futures Centre.